GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, February 1st, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Today on GeekSpeak, a conversation about the architectural geek, Buckminster Fuller, and a bunch of geek news. It is time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today. Later in the show, Lyle Troxel will chat with Jamie Snyder about the work and life of the great geek, Buckminster Fuller. And now, with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Hello, Miles.
Good morning.
And Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler.
Hello.
So, Miles, I wanted to start off by following up with something that we were talking about in an earlier show. You'd mentioned something in the Ukraine.
Yes, there was a really creepy text sent out saying, telling people that we know you're involved in this protest and you need to stop.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that was the official creepy factor of last week.
Right, and I had assumed that the telecoms were involved with it. All three of the major telecoms in Ukraine have denied involvement. So I wanted to follow up with that story. And now the general consensus is that the government had put up a temporary cell tower in the square in order to get that information. And law enforcement in many places of the world, including the U.S., have done this before. One of the side effects of that being that many times your cell phone traffic is usually encrypted, but if it connects up to a cell tower that doesn't ask for encryption, they will connect unencrypted, which means that a lot of your communications on your phone going back and forth will then be visible.
So the theory is then that the Ukraine did something like that. They put up an unencrypted cell tower and said, oh, just connect with me. I don't need your encryption. And protesters' phones went, okay. And then they had all kinds of information about who was at the protest.
It basically comes down to you put up a tower that is a stronger power output than whatever the other closest tower might be.
Okay.
And it's not that this is wholly an evil technique in
Isn't
terms
it?
Of a government doing
not?
That because the same technique is used for Burning Man, for example. They will put up temporary cell towers up
so
in the desert so that people can connect up
in dead otherwise
right
dead
because
spots.
Putting a cell tower up in the middle of the desert for when Burning Man isn't around would be kind of
right
an ish kind of difficult.
But to put it up in a public square where populations gather, say protesters and such.
Right.
It's a little hard to find how that would not be nefarious.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we've talked about that issue on GeekSpeak before, and we all were really creeped out by it. Mm-hmm. Every single time we've talked about it, we've been really creeped out by it. And, you know, here we are.
Yep. Continuing to be creeped out.
Yep. I'm still creeped out.
But just wanted to let everyone know
sure that the lay folk are creeped out. That's
yeah. Ukrainian telecoms appear to be off the hook. It really is just a
nefarious
government.
Okay. Fun times. All right. Excellent.
That makes me feel a little bit better, but that's kind of like, oh, I don't know, 5% better in terms of the overall creepiness factor.
Yeah, I'm,
you know?
I'm actually happy when you have private businesses not colluding with the government. It's because then it becomes the government plus all of these other entities. Now it's just the government.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I've been reading 1984 recently. It's the 30-year anniversary of that book.
Oh, really?
It's like anytime I hear anything about this, then I just get extra chills.
That book,
Orwellian chills,
has increased in relevance year by year.
Wait,
it feels.
It's the what year anniversary?
The 30th anniversary of 1984. Or is it the 40th?
It's longer than that. I mean,
of the book, of the year 1984.
Yeah, it's been 30 years.
The book
years
was written in 49.
Oh, got it. I was like, wait a second. George Orwell wrote
that
way before then.
Dead.
Yeah, it's the 65th anniversary. It's almost the two-thirds of a decade anniversary. I've wanted to celebrate people's two-thirds of a decade or one-third of a decade birthdays and things like that because they'll never see it coming. it's 4 months or 8 months away from their normal.
Well, actually, some people would, because our illustrious Bonnie has for many years had things like a 33 1/3 birthday.
You know, I just did that 1 year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the only time I had a 33 1/3 birthday.
Oh, because I did this, I did the exact same thing when my 33 1/3 came up. In honor of, like, I was remembering and thinking, that was so cool, and that was so much fun.
A third of the way there, you guys. All right.
It's only if we're in base 10, though.
That's true.
Base 8, things get all wonky.
Speaking of base, I hear that Israel's trying to make base up on the moon.
Kind of,
how's that for a clunky transition?
Well, that's pretty clunky, but it's okay.
I'm here to help.
I'm happy. Yeah, Israel, this actually really made me happy. There's a new story about how Israel is actually planning to do a soft landing, an unmanned spacecraft on the moon. So people aren't going, like, you know, to the moon, but to date, in 2014, I guess it is now, Russia, United States, and China have soft landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And then India hard landed, which basically means shot something into the moon. And it.
I was trying to. I'm just picking the old. It's like the difference 1920s between movie with me.
Okay, we're here versus. Yeah. You know.
Douche.
So.
Yes, patting Ben on the back is a soft landing. Shooting Ben in the back is a hard landing.
That's awful.
Terrible analogy.
Anyway, I mean, one of the reasons we hard land things is basically to kick up dust and then study what happens when you when we see light bounce off the dust,
or when we don't have a better option.
No. Oops. Well, Israel is actually up to. I think they're making a soft landing. Yeah. I assumed reading this, but now I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah, so it's truly an international game, is what I'm hearing.
Oh yeah. It is a soft landing because they actually started this project in response to Google's Lunar X Prize, mm-hmm. which is a $30 million prize. Basically, it's a competition challenging non-state-owned space agencies to go to the moon, right? Trying to get private industry to go to the moon. And so, sure enough, the agency that I'm talking about here in Israel is a nonprofit, and they're one of, I think, 20 or 30. And yeah, the goal is to land on the moon, put an Israeli flag, educate young people. Mm-hmm. They're actually going to do a seed germination experiment on the moon, and then they're going to have students on Earth do the same experiment.
Aww.
And see how things are different, which is really cool.
That's cool.
And then the other part of the challenge is to basically send back a picture of itself, you know, like, yeah. or at least photos from the moon, and also to move 500 meters, which is, you know, half a kilometer is a decent.
I have not traveled that far in the moon.
Yeah, we'll see if the Israeli flag lasts longer than the U.S. flag.
Yeah.
How long did the U.S. flag last?
Still there, right?
Well, the original one from the first moon landing was knocked over when they took off.
Oh, okay.
Other ones that have been put up there are still standing, uh-huh. but they are no longer red, white, and blue. They are straight
white. And white.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been bleached.
Yes.
By the sun's rays?
Yes. Wow. Think of the bleaching you have in a bookstore, the books that are in the shade versus the ones that are in the sun, and you look at that. Now imagine you have no atmosphere.
There's nothing to get in the way.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The UV and your pigments.
I think it's funny when I see bumper stickers with American flags on the back of cars, except the red dye fades faster than the blue dye, so you end up just with this awkward square in the corner and a white bumper sticker. Yeah,
you can kind of make it out sometimes, though.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's going to be really fun to see this thing hopefully land and everything. It hasn't launched or anything like that, but they're on their way.
Now, what
started
do you think?
On Facebook.
On Facebook?
Yeah.
What do you think the long-term effects are of having the whole globe getting in the Space Act? Just betterment for all or awkward competition? What do you think?
Awkward competition. It's better than the space race back in the
we're
U.S.
We're not quite
in
the space race, yeah.
No, but yeah. I mean, I think that especially with all of these nations collaborating to get to space, you know, like this isn't like we better get there before they do. This is kind of like, hey, let's all go to the moon. This is more fun. You know, I mean, obviously they want to be the first ones. Everyone wants to be the first ones, aside from everyone who's already been there. But yeah, I think it's only positive.
All right. Great. To everyone getting together later.
Drawing, spurring technological innovation, educating people. I mean,
it's good stuff.
It's fun.
Miles, let's get back to this idea of companies and governments either being in cahoots or not. That, you know, I saw like a Google camera car the other day, mm-hmm. jetting around trying to take the pictures.
The self-driving ones? No,
it wasn't a self-driver. It was, you know, just like a straight-up car. Yeah. And then I thought, well, that's nice. You know,
actually, it'd be really hard to tell the difference because even the self-driving cars have a human being sitting behind
the
wheel at all times.
So it's not to freak out everybody. You don't want to be an attractive nuisance and cause accidents.
Yeah. True.
I think it's also a liability issue, but yes.
Okay, yeah. So then I just assumed that Google's allowed to do whatever they want, wherever they want. But in Kansas, that's not necessarily the case.
I don't know that Google's allowed to do everything that they want. But, and I should start the story with a disclosure that I actually am a Google employee. So,
okay,
but
full disclosure.
I am not speaking for Google, and I am speaking on my own behalf.
Duly noted. Thanks for letting
which
us
is
know, Miles.
That the Kansas legislature is trying to stop further rollout of broadband.
Mm-hmm.
This is important because Google has put out what they call Google Fiber, which is the 100 megabit per second, or sorry, gigabit per second internet
fast.
Connection.
Blazing yeah. fast.
In Kansas City.
Cable.
And
okay.
It's Kansas City on both sides of the river, so Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas.
Now, is it just in Kansas, or are they doing this everywhere, the Google Fiber?
They're not doing it everywhere. They're doing it in certain cities.
Test markets.
But this was the first one that Google Fiber went to, which was Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City,
yeah.
Kansas.
So what's Kansas's objection?
This is actually indicative of many municipalities. It just happens to be hitting Google Fiber in
okay.
this case, which is saying that we don't want too many people coming in giving broadband and because it would mess up the ecosystem or something on that order.
What? Are you saying that they haven't done their environmental impact report? Just do your environmental
report? No, it's not. When I say environment, I mean business environment.
Oh, the business environment. No. Okay. Okay.
So
municipalities don't want too much competition for hardware?
Well, think of your cable company. Your
yeah.
cable company, there. If you're in a particular area, you only have one.
Yeah.
You have a choice.
Yeah.
I mean, some places may have Time Warner, some places may have Comcast, but you right. never have Time Warner and Comcast in the area to choose from.
And that's sort of annoying to consumers, I said,
yeah.
as
and
a consumer.
And the case was also true of plain old telephone service.
So then why wouldn't you want more than one way to get at something so that you don't have this kind of monopoly?
That's a fine question, because the Kansas State Legislature has a bill up there that would prohibit municipalities in the state from building their own municipal broadband networks.
Uh-huh.
And that that goes along with those municipalities teaming up with companies to provide that, like Google Fiber. And
oh.
it doesn't necessarily have to be Google Fiber. It could be anyone. But it's a lot of times you have a hard time seeing a reason to pass something like this except for the purposes of limiting the competition to the existing
so you're
providers.
Saying that Kansas yeah. is in bed with existing providers?
They aren't the only ones. I'd say
okay.
they're not the only ones.
And Kansas is an example of a municipality being in bed with an existing provider.
Right.
Okay.
And anywhere you go where you only have one cable provider to give you cable, either internet or television service.
Some sort of utility, yeah.
Or you only have one DSL provider. Because it's where your phone company is, that type
See,
of thing.
See, why would the municipality be interested in that kind of monopoly, though?
There are some that consider it a good thing for a reason that escapes me. There are others that are more blatantly just in the pocket of those businesses that they paid for their campaign.
Right. Well, I'm curious about this one. I want to hear more about it later. What's going on with municipalities? And because it just seems like it would benefit everyone to have a greater number of options.
Yeah, we've covered on the show many times in the past things like there's a town in Tennessee where the broadband providers weren't giving internet access. They just, it was a modem or nothing.
Yeah.
And so the municipality would move forward and say, okay, fine, we're going to build our own. And they did it through like the power company, I believe,
okay.
in the case of this Tennessee city.
Yeah.
And then just before they got it rolled out, and it was the pilot project was working wonderfully, and people were signing on like gangbusters.
Yeah,
you had the existing cable and telecom companies going, "Hey, wait a second! You can't do this. This is going to be unfair to us for a competition. You weren't providing it, but we didn't know that people wanted it. Now we know people want it."
Oh, sneaky Pete's.
Yeah.
All right. Well, more on that later. Gang, you're listening to Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP. A little later in the show, we'll be talking with Jamie Snyder about Buckminster Fuller. There's something along those lines happening in San Jose a little bit later. And next time on the 7th Avenue Project on 88.9 KUSP, the eminent astronomer Sandra Faber has made huge contributions to our picture of the cosmos. She's not only mapped distant galaxies and explained how they're formed, but also designed some of the ultra-sensitive instruments that made such discoveries possible. The thing that pleases her most, though, is being part of a 14-billion-year-old cosmological story going back to the Big Bang. Sandra Faber talks to host Robert Pauly about her sense of the universe and our place in it. That's next time on the 7th Avenue Project, Sunday at noon on 88.9 KUSP. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch in the host chair, and with me in the air room are Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. By the way, you can find out more about everything you hear today at geekspeak.org. And as I mentioned before the break, in a little while, Jamie Snyder and Lyle Trox will chat about the amazing Buckminster Fuller. But first, a little more geek news and advice. We had an email from a longtime podcast listener from Wisconsin who has followed Geek's advice in the past about backups and is now switching to a MacBook Pro, running Mavericks, something a little different from what she was used to, and asks if that changes how she should back up now. Gentlemen, do you have any advice for this podcast listener?
Well, my advice has always been to just make sure that you have your data in more than one place. That's number one. Mm. But beyond that, there are a number of different things you could do. Like, for example, one of the things you could do is you could create a bootable backup of your hard drive. There are a number of applications that'll do that, like SuperDuper, Carbon Copy Cloner, just to name a few.
So do you still suggest SuperDuper then? That's one question. Yeah.
So it's interesting as this space is kind of changing around. You can use Time Machine on a Mac to back up all of your stuff, and then you can restore from a Time Machine backup. But I don't think off the top of my head it's bootable, right? Do you know anything?
No, the idea is that you would be installing the operating system on a new Mac, or you just bought a new Mac, and as you're doing the setup process, it says, hey, I see this Time Machine or this time capsule elsewhere. Do you want me to go from there, or do you want me to start up clean? You can say, go from there, and then it would copy all your stuff over. I still consider that really wonderful, and I still haven't seen anything in the Windows or the Linux world that matches it.
That matches that. Yeah, it's that's fantastic. Still a good idea.
The other thing, though, is I really dislike downtime. I dislike the idea of downtime. Just being without my computer for a day, if I'm not planning it, is very very much
you want to be
painful.
Able to have access all the time.
Yeah, especially if I'm in the middle of a project or if I have deadlines or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's where a bootable backup comes in. If you want to make a bootable backup on an external hard drive, basically what you're doing is you're taking the hard drive inside of your computer and you're making a complete entire copy of it on an external drive. If your internal drive fails, then you can just start booting from your external drive and keep working, even before you have another hard drive to back up to or before you replace the hard drive inside. But Miles and I were having an interesting conversation about some of the new models of computers have SSDs. And SSDs,
a MacBook Air or a MacBook Pro, the Retina.
And really quickly, an SSD is
solid state drive. It's basically a hard drive with no moving parts. Exactly.
Yeah, which means it lasts longer.
Yeah, and the main
and
reason
smaller.
That. Yeah, the main reason that hard drives break is because moving parts stop moving, basically.
Yeah.
So
sometimes violently.
Okay.
More explosion sounds.
Sound effect for you on
Geek
Speak. So, given solid state drive, what about?
I don't know. What do you thought about this,
listeners? Situation? My thought process was more and more with the Macs anyway, and this is actually something that's caused me some distress when thinking about it, is there's no user serviceable parts. It used to be, there was something wrong, or rather there was nothing wrong, I just want to upgrade the RAM, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Or there is a problem with the hard drive or SSD, it was a standard part, I'm just going to replace that.
Yeah.
And more you have things like in the newer Retina MacBook Pros, the RAM is soldered to the motherboard.
Right.
And the SSD is of a format that is basically different from all other manufacturers. There have been a couple manufacturers that have tried that have emulated the Mac format to make aftermarket parts, but they're not.
So it's kind of like, you know, in the old days, you could just take your car to the dude at the corner garage and he'd be able to swap everything out. But now, because of all the computer stuff, you kind of have to take it to a particular place and it costs a lot more to repair.
You have to take it to Apple in most cases. I mean, they've kind of iPhone-ified the MacBook Pros because iPhones, you can't replace the battery if the battery starts not doing so well, unless you take it to Apple or unless you buy a new phone. So.
Right. And so when he was talking about that, replacing that hard drive, like having an external boot hard drive, I
think of SSDs as not being the most fragile part of the system, but the fact that they're these monolithic pieces now.
And you can't just replace your solid-state drive.
So if something goes wrong, it's like, oh, the main board went down. That replacement hard drive isn't going to help
you. You just need a whole new computer.
Or the screen broke.
Okay.
You know, like the...
So in other words, your downtime goes from, oh, I need to wait for this new part and then find a way to install it, to, oh, I need to get to an Apple store and buy a new computer, you know?
So how does that relate to bootable backups?
In that case, you don't necessarily need a bootable backup because your downtime will be smaller because you're going to have to just replace the entire computer. That's really a bummer, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But it's kind of where... That's where things are at.
And there's not a lot of getting around that. And in fact, she already has a new computer, so it's too late.
So my guess is, or my advice would be, if you have a solid state drive in your computer, if your computer's super, super fast and everything, then I wouldn't, can you replace the non-solid state parts? You can't really, can you? I'm not sure about the Retina MacBooks.
Which non-solid state parts are you talking about?
Do the Retina MacBook Pros only have solid state drives?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, okay. So, news to me. So basically, I would say then I would revise my recommendation to just use Time Machine and make sure it's backing up all your stuff. And then,
okay. So if she's planning on using Time Machine and then also doing like a super duper once a week thing, will that cover it? Or does she need something else for the Windows portion of her MacBook Pro?
Is she dual booting? Maybe. If you're dual booting, need to.
Yeah, she is dual booting, and so she does need to have Windows backup software. And you can use the Windows backup.
You can just use the one that Windows
comes with.
That's okay. That gets the geeks thumbs up.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there you go. Podcast listener from Wisconsin.
Yeah. There are other backup software out there, and some of them have better features or more advanced features or more flexibility. Mm-hmm. But as far as we're concerned, if you're making backups, you're already getting the thumbs up.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the hardest part of getting people to do. It's like
it's the social part.
You're 95% of the way there if you just do any kind of backup on a regular basis.
You're already ahead of the pack.
Yeah.
You're doing fine, hon. Okay. Good to know. More than I am. I will just admit that as an actual member of Geek Speak, my backup situation is miserable.
Aww.
We'll have to help you with that.
Yeah. Thank you. Please help me. So getting back to the international aspect of exploration.
Both
the big stuff and the little stuff. Ben, you've got something on China and dark matter.
Yes, I do. I also have another, just a quick geek bit to throw out as well.
Okay.
The geek bit is, geek bits are generally something you want to see instead of hear on the radio. We'll put it up on geekspeak.org. It's an animation of the International Space Station being assembled.
Ooh.
And the most amazing thing about this to me is watching all of the pieces that they already sent up to the ISS moving around and being repurposed and changing their location.
Like a transformer.
Unfolded, considering how compact they were to get up there in the first place.
I want to see that.
Yeah, like those are big solar panels, but they're really small when you fold them up.
Yeah, so that's up at geekspeak.org.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful to see.
And Miles, you've got a geek bit also for the programmer fans.
Yeah, these are for my programmer peeps, so... taking a little technical, so if you don't understand what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. It's not for everyone.
Okay. Now, you mentioned it to me, and I thought something else entirely. It's a big O cheat sheet.
Right, big O cheat sheet, big
How
O
to get
notation.
There? What do you,
so anyone who's ever taken the
their social lives is that
yeah anyone who's ever taken the second semester of computer science knows what big O notation is
okay. or it's knew at I'm some thinking. Point what okay. big yes. O notation was.
Well,
yeah. It's a way of measuring the complexity of certain tasks, basically.
Right.
Okay. And, which is important in a programming environment.
And so there's a cheat sheet up there, especially useful for folks who are going through that second semester of, of the class, or they're about to go into their algorithms class.
So students of programming, take note. There's a cheat sheet for you at geekspeak.org.
Right. But in a more humorous note, there's also a printable poster that's done in the style of abstinence posters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Except so instead of saying sex can wait, it's saying true bugs can wait. And they are done in the style of folks that are familiar with C code will recognize this. All my friends are using stir copy, but I'm not, because you should be using stir end copy. Believe me, among C programmers, it's really
hilarious
funny.
Hilarious for programmers. That's something just for you.
And you can find those...
Oh,
Very good. So that's up at geekspeak.org. Amusement for the programmers among us.
See, right. Programmer and jokes.
Although, if you are using Stir Copy and you don't get the joke, please look at this. And if you don't get the humor, look up why it's funny. It's
okay.
Important.
All right. Yeah. And presumably that's lookupable. All right.
Yes,
but so I'm all excited about the dark matter in China.
Yeah,
what's going on
there? Yeah. Okay. So first of all, what's dark matter? Well, dark matter.
It's that little stuff that we can't see that's between everything in space.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's a pretty good explanation.
They're still trying to figure it out. But,
Basically, there's the universe is really, really massive. In fact, it's about five times as massive as we think it should be based on what we know.
Not massive just in the sense of like, whoa, really big, but also like having weight.
Yeah, like gravitational. Yeah. We see gravitational effects that are larger than they should be given what we know.
Right.
So what scientists end up doing is they create hypotheses and they test out their hypotheses. So everybody's been going over the math of it for many, many years, and the prevailing theory is dark matter. Basically, it's this stuff, this matter, and it constitutes more than 80% of the matter in the universe. And they think it's made of what are called WIMPs or WIMPs, which are weakly interacting massive particles. I just like the acronym WIMPs.
Weakly in the sense of not strong, not on the regular.
It's one of the four fundamental forces. So it interacts only with the weak force and gravitationally, but we don't see it, right? We can't interact with it the way we would interact with, I don't know, this table here or something.
So matter goes by and it goes like, I'm going to try to interact with you.
Nope.
I'm wimpy.
All right, so to measure dark matter, you have to measure a thing that interacts with dark matter because we can't measure it directly yet.
I'm just going to say it's really complicated.
It's okay.
It turns out that one of the ways that we theoretically could detect dark matter is by taking these humongous tanks of xenon, waiting for some dark matter to interact with one of the molecules of xenon, which creates a reaction which releases a little bit of this and that, some light and also some energy.
And I presume xenon because it's a noble gas. In other words, it's not going to chemically react with other things. You can limit it. You know, you can rule out a whole lot of other reactions that are going on, and it's one of the more dense of the noble gases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And so doing these experiments, it's actually very difficult to do these experiments for a couple reasons. One is that you need a huge tank of liquid xenon. In order for it to be a liquid, it has to be cooled down. So you have to have this cooled liquid xenon. You also have to have a very big tank because the walls of the tank themselves actually emit some trace radiation, which could be detected as dark matter, but it's actually not. It's just the walls of the tank interacting with the xenon.
Okay.
And then beyond that, it has to be really far away from any kind of other radiation, like from the sun or the cosmic background radiation, that stuff. So you basically
need
to
isolate it somehow.
Yeah, so you have to build these detectors really far underground.
Oh, that's why they're doing that.
So they're building a detector in China. This is the news story, is that they just powered on.
Is it under the big dam or where are they putting it?
it's under a huge mountain in China's Sichuan province.
Okay.
And
boy, they love their big earth projects there.
Yeah,
they?
And it's going to be the biggest one, in fact. And if everything goes well, they're going to build a slightly smaller version, and then they're going to scale it up if it goes well, which would be a tank holding 2.4 metric tons of liquid xenon, which is a lot of xenon.
Gee, do they just have the run on xenon over there?
I don't know. So actually that makes it the largest one as far as I know. The other detectors are also really deep underground. There's Lux in the United States. It's at the bottom of an abandoned mine in South Dakota. There's a European one called Xenon, nicely named.
Yeah.
And that's been below some other mountain in Europe. So anyway, this is, we'll see what happens when we power it on and hopefully we'll either find that our theory is right, or
which
even
will be
more,
really boring.
That would be kind of boring, you know. But at least then we could move on and say, okay, well, we know that. So da 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 da. Or even better, we discover that we're wrong, and there's a even deeper mystery. That's what scientists
It'll never be over.
Why does that happen again? I guess we have to design an experiment. Darn. Oh well, that's what we like to do because we're scientists.
It's job security.
Yeah. So anyway, that is China's, it's called the Panda X project. I don't know what Panda X stands for because I'm looking for it now. Oh, yeah. It says particle and astrophysical xenon. I don't know where the D comes from in Panda X.
It's how you make an acronym catchy. They just add extra letters.
Exactly.
Nonprofits have been doing that for years.
Just sit around in a room, like, yeah. You know, going back and forth.
Yeah, this is kind of an acronym. So, Miles, there's a program coming to a close that I don't know what it is. Megatons to megawatts. What is this?
Yes. Did you know that a lot of the nuclear warheads used in the former Soviet Union that used to be pointed at us to destroy us had been repurposed as nuclear fuel in our nuclear reactors, the 104 that we have. Yeah. Actually, I think 102 now.
Oh, I get it. Megatons to megawatts. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Huh. That's a program that's been going for nearly 20 years.
Uh-huh. Is that just how we're getting rid of all our warheads or what?
How we're getting rid of the Soviet Union's warheads.
The Soviet Union's warheads.
Yeah, unfortunately, okay. We still have a lot of our own.
Oh, no.
So they've been at it, but we have not. And so now they're going to stop.
And so 500 metric tons of weapons-grade material made its way into nuclear reactors and used, and 20% of about 20% of all electricity in the U.S. for the last 20 or 30 years has been from the nuclear power.
Well, you're confusing me because the megatons went into Russian nuclear.
No, went into ours.
Oh gosh. Okay, so we somehow took their warheads and turned them into our energy.
Well, at the time, it was money that we were giving to them for this, and it was nuclear weapons require a huge amount of maintenance.
I would think so. I'm kind of glad to hear that it does.
Well, the thing is, to have that weapons-grade material, you know, it has to be enriched to a very high purity rate. Mm-hmm. And over time, you have decay particles going on. It degrades below that point that it would actually explode and be more of what they refer to as a fizzle. Yeah, it would just be like, you know, okay, there's a whole bunch of really expensive stuff that didn't go off. So you have to go through a constant maintenance cycle, and after a time you take a warhead out and you reprocess it and you put it back in again. Mm-hmm. And so instead of that overhead, we also paid them money to get that material so that we didn't have to mine it. Yeah. And then just use it as electricity.
Sure.
Which is what we've been doing.
And so why is the program coming to a close?
Because like a good thing. They're running out of those warheads.
Oh, we're almost done.
Yes.
Are we going to start working on our own then? No, we're just going to close the program.
That's a lot of weapons-grade stuff there. You said 500 metric tons.
500 metric tons.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
that's like 200 Panda X experiments. Like,
but that's the thing,
I said
though.
That was a lot of xenon.
Yeah.
Yeah, 500 metric tons, and you think about that, but that's really not that much. I mean, this is very dense material.
Yeah.
This is not like you have 500 metric tons of pillows.
That would take up a lot more space.
Right. It's 500 metric tons of this extremely dense material. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing that actually we went through nearly 20 years to get through that amount of material.
So was there any thought about just continuing the program and using American nuclear warheads?
Well, using American nuclear warheads would probably be a whole different thing. The idea behind megatons and megawatts was to repurpose those Soviet era materials over 2 hours. So our own nuclear warheads to other purposes, I don't know what our plans are for that.
Okay.
It would be a different name.
All right.
Different program.
And are people happy about it coming to a close? What's the feel in the international room? Any idea about that?
That I can't speak to. I don't know.
Because relations have been a little awkward between Russia and America lately, so I'm wondering if that has something to do with it, or if it's just
No. It was just because the amount of material was dropping off. I mean, because we were paying.
I'm
Soviet,
asking you if
we
there's some
Russia
reason I should
them.
Be creeped out. Is there a creep out factor of any kind in there for me? No? Okay. Everything's fine.
Well, the fact that we won't have that material and we'll have to mine again if we're going to keep our nuclear reactors going.
Yeah,
or raise the mining level anyway, the mining rate.
Okay. Huh. Well, we'll see what happens there.
That I guess that's kind of creepy.
I'm sad.
Darn, I missed
Good
the program.
Good job, guys.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. Our guest, Jamie Snyder, is a producer, director of alternative media, an educator and consultant, a writer and songwriter, and his film projects include Pablo Casas' A Cry for Peace, Henry Miller, To Paint is to Love Again, and his award-winning films, Modeling the Universe and Reflections, Buckminster Fuller. He is the co-founder of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and as Buckminster Fuller's grandson, he studied and worked with Fuller until his passing in 1983. Jamie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
We've run into each other a few times throughout the time in Santa Cruz together, and it's a pleasure to have you on to talk about your grandfather and about the work. The reason we kind of got instigated to do this is that at the San Jose Rep opening this Wednesday, but actually already in pre-production and such, is the R. Buckminster Fuller, The History and Mystery of the Universe, written and directed by D.W. Jacobs. And it's kind of an amazing journey with your grandfather, but of course on stage with actor Ron Campbell, who supposedly is amazing at doing this. Now, have you seen the show yet?
I have. It's actually, it was created, I worked on it, my mother worked on it. It was created in and premiered in 1999.
Yeah.
And then it ran for a few years in San Francisco and has been around the country, Chicago, Washington, Boston, Seattle, Montreal. And finally, he's coming to San Jose.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And he's fantastic. I mean, actually, you know, you figured the writer-director was great, and we really enjoyed him from the get-go, but you thought, well, okay, so it'll be neat, and, you know, at least they won't say anything, right? They're getting Bucky's words correct. But when we saw the actor do it for the first time, it was like, whoa.
Yeah. I was pulling together the content for the show today and pulled some images up of your grandfather. And, of course, when you look for Buckminster Fuller, you see all these pictures of domes, right? Like, that's the geometric dome is, like, kind of the iconic image of your grandfather. And, of course, the car and, I mean, all the design work he did, the imagery is just fantastic. And in doing that, the San Jose Rep also sent me press shots of the show with Ron Campbell, the actor, in some of these kind of iconic shots of Bucky in lecture environments. And I thought they were shots of Bucky at first because I don't know, you know, his exact look. So it's great to see that. And I'm looking forward to the show on Wednesday and, to see it.
And that's what the San Jose Rep. They actually started the run. They call it previews.
But the previews open already. Yeah.
Officially open on Wednesday.
And it runs through the 23rd, and that's the San Jose Rep. And you can learn more by going to geekspeak.org. We've got links and all that. So your father's known as a designer and an influencer of thought, and in multiple disciplines, Bucky is kind of heralded as a core principle that people talk about, like crystallography, his work shows up. Archaeology, of course, architecture, of course, his work shows up because he defined a style of building. And in fact, in the early years with his father-in-law, he actually patented a system of building which was kind of one of those early cases in looking at how to reuse materials better for construction. And a kind of a quintessential moment in his life, is what I've been reading up and researching on, is what happened to him in 72 after he lost his first daughter.
27,
excuse me. And there's this story of him on Lake Michigan kind of looking at his life and kind of, he told the story that it was a suicidal almost moment and then a visionary moment. And we were talking about before the show that it kind of changed the way he looked at life a bit. And I want to quote what he used to quote on stage. "From now on, you need never await temporal accession to your thought. You think the truth. You do not have the right to eliminate yourself. You do not belong to you. You belong to universe. Your significance will remain forever obscure to you, but you may assume that you are fulfilling your role if you apply yourself to converting your expressions to the highest advantage of others." It's a very, it's a beautifully, slowly, I'm sure, crafted thing that he's said over the years. But that idea that you direct yourself to the good of everyone and let that be a way to ride through the world. It's interesting because in reading up on Bucky, I remind myself of my hippie parents, right, and how they thought about the world and realizing, well, this is where those thought processes came from, this idea of the world being synergetic. It started with your grandfather, with Bucky. And it's hard to get, I feel very optimistic as a geek. I look at technology and get really excited about it, right? But I also have this very early kind of hippie look of life where everyone should take care of each other. That's a fundamental aspect of me. I never thought of that as a connected thing at all. right? But Bucky definitely connects that to some degree. So tell me, you took a year off from, you're doing physics at UCSC, you take a year off after being there a couple of years, and you travel with your grandfather doing lecture series. What was it like to hear him speak to the public?
It was very powerful. I mean, of course, growing up with him, he was very close to our family. He always spent Christmas with us, and I spent a lot of time with him in the summer. He taught me to sail, taught me a lot of geometry. He was always showing me, you know, taught me how to tie my shoes. He had a very innovative way, even though I don't think it was actually one of his better inventions, but he did have an interesting way of tying a string to a drawer in the kitchen so I could practice tying it. But what I don't understand was why I didn't just practice on my shoe.
Uh-huh.
But in any event, he was always coming up with stuff like that.
So he was it, yeah.
So traveling him was very natural, I mean, in the sense that I had spent a lot of time with him. I had traveled, but it really was quite something, because at that particular point in his life, after the success of the geodesic dome, he kind of got catapulted into being asked by universities and institutions all over the world. And so when I was traveling with him in, actually that would have been in the early 73, 74,
yeah,
he had a major speaking commitment like every 3 days.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I remember the first talk I walked into, and I had been to talks with him, and I'd heard him always, you know, I was around enough growing up that I heard him talking to people all the time. He would always be telling them whatever was going on. Not so much because he felt he was the most important person in the room, but people were always interested in what he had to say, and so then he could go on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
So, but it was fantastic traveling around with him, and it was, you know, I guess two things come to mind. One, it was very powerful, and it didn't grow old, because Bucky had a discipline which was, and he had a lot of these disciplines, little practices. He never wanted to think about what he was going to say before he said it.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't want to, like, prepare his talks. He said, I'm going to have to do my own thinking out loud.
He used that term, do your own thinking.
A lot, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the truth is, I guess, he was sharing what he had learned in his life in so many contexts all the time that it was just natural. And each talk was different, but in a certain sense it wove together the same themes.
One of his themes was this idea, and he would get up on stage and ask the audience, who here knows the word synergy? And only a few people would raise their hand. And he'd say, exactly. No one knows this word, but it's the most important thing you could possibly. So tell me, what would he say about synergy? Why is it important?
Well, because, first of all, he would define it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I say, first of all, he defined it, which was that synergy is the behavior, this was his definition, synergy was the behavior of whole systems unpredicted by the behaviors of their parts taken separately. And synergy, I think somebody will do a PhD study at his role in taking synergy out of the chemistry labs into the public language.
Yeah.
And now, you know, now there's a synergy gym and there's synergy vitamins. And,
you know, it's interesting because now the word doesn't have as much meaning because we use
right.
it so much. But
right.
that term that he uses, the definition, to me reminds me very much of emergent properties is the way we call it now. So when we talk about how quantum physics actually relate to the real world, it's an emergent property of quantum physics that we see what we see, right? When you talk about traffic jams, that's an emergent quality of the systems of driving, right? So that term, that synergy he would use now we would use emergent as the kind of terminology that complex systems show another side effect that is larger than the whole. And that's what he was talking about, yes. right?
A yeah. synergetic effect.
Right, exactly.
Why is that important? Because you can't solve problems very effectively. I mean, he said you've got to start with the whole system. You're not going to be effective in solving problems if you just sort of look at the pieces first, because you're not going to be taking into consideration how all of these the parts interrelate with each other,
yeah.
and we lose them. So he said that was a big problem with the educational system. We sort of break it all apart and say, okay, first you got to learn your A and right. your B, and then we're going to teach you your C and your D, and then we'll got your 1 and your 2. Now we'll put those together, and it's kind of building up. He said, look, you know, the kids are already born geniuses, and they're quickly de-geniused by all of
by
this.
By breaking things down into little parts that mean nothing.
And being said, well, that's what you got to really focus on is all these little pieces.
Yeah. He also chatted about that our basic idea of scarcity, that concept that Thomas Mathers kind of created and created our economic society in some ways, the way we think about there's this many people growing on the planet, and there's this many resources of food, and therefore scarcity is real and scary and dangerous. And Bucky's perspective is, wait a second, we can change and model, we can design the world to work more efficiently and better, and therefore this isn't as scary, it's more of an opportunity to change the world to make it more efficient. And now we have these terms of efficiency, which is kind of what Bucky was talking about. You gave this great example of like trying to change people versus changing the environment. How'd that work for Bucky? How do you see that in what he said?
Well, you know, I think first of all, with regard to Thomas Malthus, it wasn't that Thomas Malthus was wrong. It was just that at that time, we had not learned what we knew in the 150 years that spanned between Thomas Malthus and Buckminster Fuller, and mm-hmm. he said. He was just sort of the first person looking this direction, but he said if you really realize that through effective design, we can do so much more with so much less in terms of use of materials. And we see this all the time. I mean, we're sitting here with our laptops, and I mean, I think of this computer's more powerful than the mainframes that Bucky hoped someday he would get in the 60s, and that's more with less. Yeah. I mean, it's actually interesting. It's funny that it's somewhat been people think of that as Moore's law, but it's actually much broader than that in terms of because it shows up in every system. It's a synergetic effect. And so he said it wasn't that Malthus was wrong. It's just that we've learned so much about how to design things and use materials more efficiently, better designs, higher efficiency, that we have come to the point where it is possible to sustain 100% of humanity, even though the population has grown greatly and is still going to grow before it is expected to level off. But we've learned how to do so much with so little that we can actually take care of, sustain 100% of humanity while phasing out the use of fossil fuels and nuclear energy. And he was a very early proponent of renewable energy in the early 60s. And
he definitely has a visionary and a definition of a lot of different concepts. You know, he was speaking about things of this nature that he taught people how to think this way, right? So we see great leaps in efficiency in industry because of these ideas. And it's pretty amazing to see that now, well, of course, we talk about being more efficient. Like that's the way to save energy is be more efficient with the use of it, right? But that wasn't the way you thought about it. This wasn't the way it used to be thought about. It's
fantastic. Well, and unfortunately, we don't. I mean, you and I may think of it that way, and a lot of people think of that way, and thank goodness there's tons of people who think of that way, but a lot of us, the reflex on a day-to-day basis is like, well, you need more energy. We'll just get more energy,
right,
rather than the most cost-effective way to get more energy is to use it more efficiently.
You are currently working on a project to take some of his books and reproduce them and add content from the giant archive of his life and beautiful designs of the cover work of it. Can you tell me one of the books you've just recently released that's now back in production?
Well, actually, one that's sort of fun for Geek Speak is just a book called Education Automation, a great book that really was kind of prophetic in terms of the information revolution. Here's, for example, something he says in 1962. Said, children will be able to call up any kind of information they want about any subject and get the latest authoritative TV documentary. The answers to their questions and probings will be the best information that is available up to that minute in history. He said,
it sounds optimistic and frou-frou, and it's totally true.
Right. He said, you're faced with a future in which education is going to be number one among the world's greatest industries. which will flourish, an educational machine technology that will provide tools such as the individually selected articulated two-way TV and intercontinentally networked documentaries call-up system operative over any home two-way TV set.
I love it. I love that he has to use the terminology of the day, two-way TV set, right?
Right, right?
But he's perfectly describing how my children live right now, right?
Right.
When my kids want to know any subject, we're like, oh, just pull up this and search for that, and there's a YouTube video and someone doing it, right?
Right.
Teaching them how to do it. It's really, we live in that space. So yeah. Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why we're talking about Buckminster Fuller, your grandfather, with Jamie Snyder, is that the San Jose Reps got a show happening throughout the month of February. You can go and learn more about it. Just go to geekspeak.org or sjrep.com to learn more about it. I'm going to be there Wednesday. I hope that you are in the audience with me as well. And Jamie, thank you for coming down and doing Geek Speak. I feel like we could talk for hours and hours about...
Well, I would enjoy talking. I mean, I think there's a lot of relevance whenever you need a little extra geek on the global, planetary, what's happening side of it. I'd be happy to come and talk about interesting stuff.
I'm looking forward to it. You can learn a lot more about what Jamie does. Just go to geekspeak.org. We have tons of links about the different stuff about his father and about his publications and work. Thank you, Jamie, for joining me on Geek Speak.
Thank you. It's an honor.
And this has been Geek Speak for February 1st, 2014. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So go ahead and reuse our stuff any way you like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. And thank you for listening.
Thanks, Bonnie. That was fun.
Yeah, thanks.
See you next week.
See ya.
Hey, podcast listeners.
How's it going?
So, you know, after the show, Jamie and I just started yakking, and sometimes I start my camera recording.
It still sounded interesting. I'm glad you recorded it, because now we can provide it for everyone who's listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah, so it's extra content, and it's not the same kind of quality as we're on air, because we use just a cheap phone, but... Yeah. Here you go. Here's a conversation with Jamie after the show.
Treat for you guys.
To be displayed on this giant map of the Earth, and they would be able to have teams of people playing to try out different ways. He said sort of as an alternative to war games, you could have a world game where you're working on how do we use the world's resources more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now all that gaming technology is here, but nobody's really created that.
Yeah.
So
you do public speaking and like consulting work, right?
Yeah.
So do you have a lecture series you do? I mean, how do you make a living?
How do I make a living? I, by hook or by crook.
Little this isn't that.
Well, it's sort of coming together. You know, I've just finally started consulting. You know, I used to teach. It's just gone through a lot of phases. I'm not doing tons of public speaking right now. I'm actually doing a lot of writing and working on a book and working on a CD for my music. But I do speak. I created a workshop, all these different things, called Trim Tabbing, a Trim Tabbing workshop. Trim Tab with another one of these little principles. Trim Tab's a small rudder on a big rudder that used on planes and early boats.
Mm-hmm.
And Bucky said, and so... Trim Tab is a little rudder, creates a low pressure, turns the big rudder, turns the big ship. And he said, on his gravestone, he had us put, call me Trim Tab.
So you have a large control system, and then that large control system you actually modify by a very small control system. That's
right.
A Trim Tab.
And okay. Exactly. The other part of the analogy is that I think is always interesting. Most people don't realize boats and planes are steered from the back.
Uh-huh.
So in some ways, we tend to think, you know...
Steer from the front,
but that's very inefficient, actually, leverage-wise. You can't turn a ship,
right.
A big ship of state. So Bucky said, well, if you really wanted to turn Spaceship Earth, then, you know, he's back here at the tail of the rudder, sticking out his little finger, creating little low pressures back here, which is actually the highest leverage point in the system. But I think that the...
So,
metaphorically it's really
political
about...
Political systems too, right?
Like, yeah, it's also very practically, how can we learn... Because we make this mistake in a lot of ways in the way we think. Again, it's back to that energy thing. we tend to think, oh, well, if you need more energy, just get more energy.
Right.
And so a lot of times we don't realize that in the our own engineering of the design of our lives, that we don't tend to think and recognize that little things that we're doing over time actually can have a tremendous amount of leverage. And so it's really about, as Bucky said, you know, it's what can the his experiment, what can the individual do that right. corporations can't do, that political systems can't do, that religions can't do, and the individual can take initiatives, the individual can think, and the individual can solve problems in their local, in their, whatever their setting may be, and that's the way it's actually going to change. I mean, he said that one of the last things, we did a series of talks right before he passed on, we ended up, a long story on that, but called Integrity Day. And he basically, you know, where he really came to was, if we already have on the shelf everything we need to make the world work. It's not like we need to invent new windmills or something. They're all here.
Right.
We could actually phase out fossil fuel. It's just a matter of, you know,
motivation.
Motivation and gumption and enough, you know, ultimately. But he said, you know, it's not going to be whether the political systems are going to make the change, though that will have to happen. It's going to be, are there really, what's going to make the difference, are there enough individuals who, it's like just what Pete Seeger said in his own different way, I heard him recounting that. But if enough individuals demonstrate enough integrity in the way they're functioning, that's what will turn the tide, because mm-hmm. it's all sitting here. It's just that right now the game is kind of rigged and hacked and you've got systems where
you have a giant ship that's traveling in a certain direction and steering, and it's going to take some time. Yeah.
Yes. So that's the other part of DreamTest that people overlook is we tend to think if I can't get an immediate effect right now, then I'm not doing anything.
Right.
And they don't realize, but wait a minute, if I am applying this force over here
slowly
over five years.
Well, so you
you're sitting on my jacket. So that's
why you're here. I thought you were interested.
No, I was very interested.
And
I also unfortunately have three generations waiting for me to go right now. Yeah.
So am I going to see you at Scotty's later?
You're going to see me at Scotty's, and you're going to see
me at my house.
Masumi at Scotty's.
Am I going to see you guys at my house tonight?
Me and Masumi.
Okay. Okay. All right.
And me, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll see you.
Good.
All right.
Thanks. So you were saying, like, so one of the things that fascinates me is that...
Ciao. Yeah, pleasure to meet you. You're a musician too, huh?
I am, yes.
Okay, well, I'll have to find out more about that. Maybe Lyle can point
me. Yeah. Put it online.
Yeah, really.
You just have to put him in front of with an instrument and give him time, and then he creates...
Is he like a Pro Tools programmer type of stuff?
No, I think he mostly just live instruments mostly.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, he'll grab a piano and go off on it, and he loves, like... He's got one of those ears where you can play something and he'll have to finish that piece.
Right.
So, yeah, we had a whole fun show once where I left, I think, a message for Ben, and it was like, pah, 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 or something like that. And he had to finish that, but I did it kind of inversely. So we talked all about that the whole episode of the Geek Speak. So the thing that fascinates me is this idea of being overwhelmed. Because I've known a lot of people that look at that large picture, see the world is, and then go, there's nothing I can do about it, it's depressing. Even if I do work my butt off all my life to make change, the world's still going to be crappy. Like, there's it's easy to fall into that space, especially when you think about big picture stuff, because things are so messed up. That's a reality level. So it's a way of living your life and being optimistic that you don't get overwhelmed by that and still move forward. What philosophy helped Bucky do that? How did he do that?
Well, see, Bucky didn't consider himself, just to be clear, an optimist. He said, I'm not an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. You will appreciate. I'm a mechanic. I'm an air pilot. I'm a captain of a ship, an auto mechanic. I just know that we have possible to get this ship to the other side. So I'm telling you that you're optimistic because you think I'm optimistic because you didn't realize we had an option. But we do have an option to make it. We just... It's up to us whether we're going to exercise it or not.
So you're more of a practical fellow than an optimist or a pessimist.
Yeah, I mean, he was like an engineer. It's like, how are we going to solve this problem? And I think what you're talking about has a lot to do with ignorance about troubleshooting systems. You know, yes, it is a very complex system, but that's where the ignorance is we've led to believe, but also just it's kind of like going around that little...
What's that?
Thanks.
Yeah.
That it's just it's ignorance that thinks that we don't have any power. Mm-hmm. That's the illusion. It's yes, everybody, that is kind of going around. Everybody, that's a reflex of everybody's, I can't do anything, it's so large. But that's what but that's not true.
Right.
It's a nice philosophy that we can't make any difference, but you know, unfortunately, whether we're conscious of it or not, we are making a difference.
We are doing it all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
We are. And if we're abdicating our conscious application of that, then we're just another part of the system that's clogging, you know, the wheels.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because we also think about people that we think about systems changing because of these actions. This one moment in time caused World War II or whatever it is. Right.
Right.
But in reality, life is not binary like that. It's system. All these systems are synergetic, right?
Right.
So you, if you think of it that way, it's not about being the person that changed the world. It's being a person that changes the world and being conscious of that and always doing that.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about it because this is sort of, I'm doing a lot of writing on this, and this is what sort of interests me. It came to me recently. You know, we're all kind of hip to. Oh, shoot, I gotta go in a second.
Okay.
We're all kind of hip. We, you know, we sort of know enough now. We've been around modern science to know that the body, if it gets sick, it's got, you know, there are like bacteria in the system and there are antibodies. And so we know that this is the way the system of our body deals, is that millions, I don't know what the numbers are, millions of these, you know, immune system sends out this immune response through all of these white blood cells and however else it works to deal with the problem. Well, that's the nature of the problem. We have a kind of a cancer of ignorance on our planet. But just the notion, it's almost kind of grandiose to think, well, if I can't just solve the problems myself, then I can't do anything.
Right.
You know, and rather than, wait a second, the way this is going to work is just like the body where, it's
not like
be,
some magical thing that's going to take out the disease. It's one thing. It's the entire
right. It's going to be millions of these little cells all over the place. All of a sudden, like, you know, oh my God, just like Bucky did. All of a sudden, like, now I'm going to start solving problems and realizing, okay, well, I'm going to retool my system, and I'm going to realize that every choice I'm making is steering the system some way or another.
Yeah.
Even though, yes, you know, it may appear to be tiny. There are millions and millions of people. And the good news is this design revolution is happening. I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's really huge. And I mean, alternative energy is exploding on the planet. Yes, it's, you know, we're coming from 30 points down in the beginning of the fourth quarter. But, you know, so
it's
what?
Happening. Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So cool. I'm going to take, I've been recording this too, so I'll throw this up on the podcast.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
So this, I was going to ask you, so you guys do put out a podcast.
Yeah. Bonnie's editing right now. So.
Okay, great.
Oh, did you want to try this now? Here.